half had a cigarette or a joint in the other. All 12 bouncing breasts were fair game for the guys. In fact, all exposed flesh, male or female, was available to everyone. Touching and clutching were encouraged. Bodies came together, hunching and lurching, then parted and moved to the next one. Some of the guests were loud and rowdy, while others appeared to be fading under the flood of alcohol and chemicals. Most appeared to be singing along with the band. Several locked lips and long kisses, while their free hands searched for even more intimate places. "I believe that's you with the sunglasses," Wright said smugly. "Thank you." Sunglasses, yellow pirate's cap, off-white gym shorts drooping low, a lean body with pale winter skin in need of sunshine. A plastic cup in one hand, a cigarette in the other, mouth open to sing along. A drunken fool, a 20-year-old lunatic on the verge of another blackout. Now, 5 years later, there was no nostalgia, no longing for those rowdy and carefree college days. He didn't miss the hell-raising, the hangovers, the late-morning wake-ups in strange beds. But at the same time, there was no remorse. Kyle felt a little embarrassed that he'd been caught on tape, but it was a long time ago. His college days had been pretty typical, hadn't they? He'd partied no more and certainly no less than virtually everyone he knew. The music stopped for a moment, between songs, and more shots were prepared and passed around. One of the girls fell into a chair and appeared to be done for the night. Then another song began. "This goes for about 8 more minutes," Wright said, glancing at his notes. Kyle had no doubt that Wright and his gang had analyzed and memorized every second, every frame. "As you will note, Elaine Keenan is not present. She says she was next door, drinking with some friends."
"So she's changed her story again."
Wright ignored this and said, "If you don't mind, I'll fast forward a little, to the point where the police show up. Remember the cops, Kyle?"
"Yes."
The video scrambled forward for a minute or so until Wright pressed a key. "At 11:25, the party comes to an abrupt halt. Listen." In mid-song, and with most of the 15 still in view, dancing and drinking and yelling, someone off-camera clearly yelled, "Cops! Cops!" Kyle watched himself as he grabbed a girl and disappeared from view. The music stopped. The lights were out. The screen was almost completely dark. Wright continued, "According to our records, the police were called to your apartment 3 times that spring. This was the 3rd time. A young man by the name of Alan Strock, one of your roommates, answered the door and chatted up the officers. He swore that there was no underage drinking. Everything was fine. He'd be happy to turn off the music and keep things quiet. The cops gave him a break and left with a warning. They assumed everybody else was hiding in the bedrooms."
"Most of them fled through the back door," Kyle said.
"Whatever. The cell phone video was on voice activation, so it clicked off after 60 seconds of near silence. It was at least 20 feet from the front door. Its owner ran off in the panic, forgot about it, and in the melee, someone knocked things around on the counter. The cell phone got bumped, so the picture got adjusted. We can't see as much as we could before. About 20 minutes pass, and all is quiet. At 11:48, there are voices, and the lights come on." Kyle moved closer to the screen. About 1/3 of the view was blocked by something yellow. "Probably a phone book, the yellow pages," Wright said. The music started again, but at a much lower volume. The 4 roommates, Kyle, Alan Strock, Baxter Tate, and Joey Bernardo, were walking around the den in shorts and t-shirts and holding drinks again. Elaine Keenan walked through the den, talking non-stop, then sat on the edge of the sofa, smoking what appeared to be a joint. Only half of the sofa was visible. A television, unseen, was turned on. Baxter Tate walked over to Elaine, said something, then put his drink down and yanked off his t-shirt. He and Elaine fell into a pile on the sofa, obviously making out while the other 3 watched television and milled about. They were talking, but the music and TV drowned out their words. Alan Strock walked in front of the camera, pulling off his t-shirt and saying something to Baxter, whose view was blocked. There were no sounds from Elaine. Less than half of the sofa was visible now, but a tangle of bare legs could be seen. Then the lights were turned off, and for a second the room was dark. Slowly,
The glare from the television focused and bounced off the walls to provide some illumination. Joey Bernardo came into view, also pulling off his shirt. He stopped and stared at the sofa, where some manner of frenzied activity was underway.
"Listen,"
Wright hissed. Joey said something that Kyle could not understand. "Did you get that?" Wright asked. "No." Wright stopped the video and said, "Our experts have studied the audio. Joey Bernardo says to Baxter Tate, 'Is she awake?' Tate is obviously having sex with Elaine, who's passed out drunk, and Bernardo stops by, takes it all in, and wonders if the girl is actually conscious. You want to hear it again?" "Yes." Wright reset the video, then replayed it. Kyle leaned down, and with his nose 6 inches from the screen, he watched hard, listened even harder, and heard the word, "awake." The detective shook his head gravely. The action continued, with the music and the television as a backdrop, and though the den of their apartment was dark, figures could be seen in the shadows. Baxter Tate finally got off the sofa, stood, appeared to be completely nude, and walked away. Another figure, Joey Bernardo, quickly took Baxter's place. Some of the sounds could barely be heard. A steady clicking arose from the scene. "We think that's the sofa," Wright said. "Don't suppose you could help on that one?" "No." And before long, there was a high-pitched heaving sound, and the clicking stopped. Joey moved from the sofa and disappeared. "That's pretty much the end of the movie," Wright said. "The video goes on for another 12 minutes, but nothing happens. If the girl, Elaine, ever moved or got off the sofa, then it's not on the video. We're almost certain that Baxter Tate and Joey Bernardo had sex with her. There's no evidence that either you or Alan Strock did."
"I did not. I can assure you of that."
"Any idea where you were during the rapes, Kyle?" Wright asked the question, then pressed a key and the screen went blank.
"I'm sure you have a theory."
"Okay." Wright was armed again with his pen and legal pad. "Elaine says she woke up several hours later, around 3 in the morning, naked, still on the sofa, and suddenly had a vague recollection of being raped. She panicked, wasn't sure where she was, admits she was still very drunk, eventually finds her clothes, gets dressed, sees you, fast asleep, in a recliner facing the television. When she sees you, she realizes where she is, and remembers more of what happened to her. There's no sign of Strock, Tate, or Bernardo. She speaks to you, shakes your shoulder, but you do not respond, so she hurries from the apartment, goes next door, and eventually falls asleep."
"And doesn't mention rape for 4 days, right, Detective? Or has she changed her story again?"
4 days is correct."
"Thank you. Not a word to anyone for 4 days. Not to her roommates, her friends, parents, no one. Then suddenly she decided she was raped. The police were very suspicious of her story, right? They finally showed up at our apartment and at the Beta House, and they asked questions and got very few answers. Why?
Because there was no rape. Everything was consensual.
Believe me, Detective, that girl would consent to anything."
"How could she consent if she was unconscious, Kyle?"
"If she was unconscious, how could she remember being raped? There was no medical exam, no rape kit, no evidence whatsoever, just the blacked-out memory of a very confused young woman. The cops dropped the case 5 years ago, and it should be dropped now."
"But it's not. It's here. The grand jury believed the video proves there was a rape."
"That's bullshit and you know it. This isn't about rape. This is about money. Baxter Tate's family is filthy rich. Elaine has found herself a greedy lawyer. The indictment is nothing but a shakedown."
"So you're willing to risk this spectacle of a trial and a conviction? You want the jury to see that video? You and your 3 roomies drunk out of your minds while a young woman is taken advantage of?"
"I didn't touch her."
"No, but you were there. Very close by. Less than 10 feet away."
"Come on."
"I don't remember it."
"How convenient."
Kyle slowly got to his feet and walked to the bathroom. He filled another plastic cup with tap water, drained it, refilled it, and drank it. Then he sat on the edge of the bed and buried his head in his hands. No, he did not want the jury to see the video. He had just seen it for the first time and prayed it would be the last. He had a visual of himself and his three pals sitting in a crowded courtroom, lights dimmed, judge frowning, jurors gaping, Elaine crying, his parents stoic in the front row as the video is played to a rapt audience. The scene made him sick. He felt innocent, but he wasn't convinced the jurors would agree. Wright ejected the disc and placed it carefully back into a plastic case. Kyle stared at the industrial-grade carpet for a long time. There were sounds in the hallway, muffled voices, feet shuffling. Maybe the Phibbies were getting restless. He really didn't care. His ears were ringing, and he wasn't sure why. Each fleeting thought was chased away by the next, and he found it impossible to concentrate, to think rationally, to focus on what should and should not be said. Decisions made at this ugly moment could reverberate forever. For a moment, he settled on the three Duke lacrosse players who were falsely accused of raping a stripper. They were eventually cleared of everything, but only after an excruciating trip to hell and back. And there was no video, no link whatsoever to the victim. "Is she awake?" Joey says to Baxter. How many times would that question echo around the courtroom? Frame by frame, word by word. The jurors would have the video memorized by the time they retired to consider the verdicts. Wright sat patiently at the table, hairy hands folded again and motionless on his legal pad. Time meant nothing. He could wait forever. "Are we at midfield?" Kyle asked, breaking the silence.
"Past midfield, around the 40 and driving."
"I'd like to see the indictment."
"Sure."
Kyle stood and looked down at the folding table. The detective began a series of movements that were immediately confusing. First, he pulled his wallet out of his rear left pocket, removed his driver's license, and placed it on the table. He produced his Pittsburgh PD badge and laid it on the table. From a box on the floor, he pulled other cards and other badges and began arranging them in line on the table. He reached for a file, handed it to Kyle, and said,
"Happy reading."
The file was labeled Information. Kyle opened it and removed a stack of papers stapled together. The top one looked official. A bold title read, "Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Allegheny County, Court of Common Pleas." A smaller heading read, "Commonwealth versus Baxter F. Tate, Joseph N. Bernardo, Kyle L. McAvoy, and Alan B. Strock." There was a docket number, file number, and other official markings. Wright produced a pair of kitchen scissors and methodically cut his driver's license into two perfect squares. The first paragraph read, "This prosecution is in the name of and by the authority of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania against the above-named defendants." Wright was cutting some of the other plastic cards, all of which appeared to be either driver's licenses or credit cards. "Who, within the jurisdiction of this court?" Wright ripped his bronze badge from its leather wallet and bounced it on the table.
"What are you doing?" Kyle finally asked.
"Destroying the evidence."
"What evidence?"
"Read page 2. Kyle, who was at the bottom of page 1, flipped to page 2. It was blank. Not a word, letter, period, anything. He flipped to page 3, then 4, then 5. All blank. Wright was busy removing other badges. Kyle held the bogus indictment and gawked at the detective.
"Have a seat, Kyle,"
Wright said with a smile as he waved at the empty folding chair. In an effort to say something, Kyle managed only a dying whimper. Then he sat down.
"There is no indictment, Kyle,"
Wright proceeded as if it all made sense now. "No grand jury, no cops, no arrest, no trial. Nothing but a video."
"No cops?"
"Oh no, this stuff is all fake." He waved his hands over the pile of destroyed identification. "I'm not a cop. Those boys across the hall are not FBI agents." Kyle rolled his head back like a wounded boxer, then rubbed his eyes. The indictment fell to the floor.
"Who are you?"
he managed to grunt.
"That's a very good question, Kyle. One that will take a long time to answer."
In disbelief, Kyle picked up one of the badges, Ginyard's, FBI. He rubbed it and said,
"But I checked this guy out online. He really works for the FBI.
Yes, these are real names. We just borrowed them for the night.
So you're impersonating an officer?
Certainly, but it's just a small offense. Not worth your trouble.
But why?
To get your attention, Kyle. To convince you to come here and have this little meeting with me. Otherwise, you might have run away. Plus, we wanted to impress you with our resources.
We?
Yes, my firm. You see, Kyle, I work for a contractor, a private one, and we've been hired to do a job. We need you, and this is how we recruit people.
Kyle blew out a chestful of nervous laughter. His cheeks were getting warm. The blood was beginning to circulate. There was a rising thrill at the relief of not being prosecuted, of having been rescued from the firing squad.
But the anger was beginning to boil.
You recruit by blackmail?
He asked.
If necessary.
We have the video.
We know where the girl is. She does indeed have a lawyer.
Does she know about the video?
No, but if she saw it, your life could get very complicated.
I'm not sure I follow you.
Come on, Kyle. Rape has a 12-year statute of limitations in Pennsylvania. You have 7 years to go. If Elaine and her lawyer knew about the video, they would threaten criminal prosecution to force a civil settlement. It would be, as you say, nothing but a shakedown, but it would work. Your life will go much smoother if you play along with us and we keep the video buried.
So you're recruiting me?
Yes.
To do what?
To be a lawyer.
Chapter 5. With a crushing weight suddenly lifted from his shoulders, and with his breathing somewhat normal again, Kyle glanced at his watch. It was after midnight. He looked at Wright, or whatever the hell his name really was, and he wanted to smile and even hug the man because he wasn't a cop from Pittsburgh and he didn't deliver an indictment. There would be no arrest, no prosecution, no humiliation, and for this, Kyle was euphoric. But at the same time, he wanted to bolt across the table and punch Wright's face with as much violence as he could generate, then knock him to the floor and kick him until he didn't move. He vetoed both ideas. Wright was fit and probably trained and could take care of himself, and he certainly wasn't the type anyone would want to hug. Kyle leaned back in his chair, placed his right ankle on his left knee, and relaxed for the first time in hours.
"So what's your real name?" he asked.
Wright was preparing a new legal pad for a fresh round of note-taking. He entered the date in the top left corner.
We're not going to waste time with frivolous questions, Kyle.
Oh? Why not? You can't even tell me your name?
Let's stick with Benny Wright for now. It doesn't really matter because you'll never know the real name.
I like this. Real cloak and dagger shit.
You guys are good. Really had me going there for about 4 hours. Had a knot in my colon as big as a pumpkin. Already thinking about finding a nice bridge to wing it from.
I hate your guts. Don't ever forget it.
When you shut up, we can get down to business.
Can I walk out right now?
Sure.
And no one will grab me. No more fake badges and phony FBI agents?
None. Go. You're a free man.
Oh, thank you.
A minute passed without a word. Wright's fierce little eyes never left Kyle's face, while Kyle, hard as he tried, could not return the stare. His foot twitched and his eyes darted and he drummed his fingers on the table. His mind raced through 100 scenarios, but he never once thought of leaving the room.
"Let's talk about your future, Kyle," Wright finally said.
"Sure. Now that I won't be arrested, the future has certainly improved."
"This job you're planning to take, Piedmont Legal Aid, why do you want to waste a couple of years saving the world?"
"Don't really see it that way. There are a lot of migrant workers in Virginia, many of whom are illegal, and they're subjected to all sorts of abuse. They live in cardboard boxes, eat rice twice a day, work for $2 an hour, often don't get paid for backbreaking work, and so on. I figure they could use some help."
"But why?"
"It's public interest law, okay?
Obviously you don't get it. It's lawyers giving their time to help others. They still teach this in law school. Some of us believe in it."
Wright was not impressed.
"Let's talk about Scully and Pershing."
"What about them? I'm sure you've done your research."
"They offered you a job?"
"Correct.
Beginning when?
September 2nd of this year. I take the bar in July and would start working in September.
As an associate?
No, as a full-fledged partner.
Or how about a secretary or a copy clerk?
Come on, Benny, you know the routine.
Don't get angry, Kyle.
We have a long way to go.
I see.
And we should cooperate now and be pals because we're striving for a common purpose. Just you and me, right, Benny? A couple of old friends. Where the hell is this going?
It's going to Scully and Pershing.
What if I don't want to work there?
You have little choice.
Kyle leaned on his elbows and rubbed his eyes. The folding table was narrow. Their faces were 2 feet apart.
Have you said no to Scully and Pershing?
Wright asked. I'm assuming you already know the answer to that question. I'm assuming you've been listening to my phone conversations for some time.
Not all of them.
You're a thug.
Thugs break legs, Kyle.
We're much too smart for that. No, I have not said no to Scully and Pershing. I've informed them that I'm giving serious thought to public interest law for a couple of years, and we've even discussed a deferment. They've given me extra time, but I need to make a decision.
So they still want you?
Yes. At a starting salary of $200,000. Something like that. You know the numbers.
One of the largest and most prestigious law firms in the world.
The largest. At least that's what they tell everybody.
Big firm, important clients, wealthy partners with contacts everywhere. Come on, Kyle, it's an offer most law students would kill for. Why not take it?
Kyle jumped to his feet and paced to the door and back. He glared down at Wright and said,
Let me make sure I follow you. You want me to take the job at Scully and Pershing for reasons that I'm sure will be against my best interests, and if I say no, then you'll blackmail me with the video and the rape allegations.
Right? Is this where we're headed, Benny?
More or less.
Blackmail is such an ugly word.
Wouldn't want to offend anyone, Benny. I'm sure you're very sensitive.
But it's blackmail, or extortion, or whatever you'd like to call it. It's a crime, Benny, and you're a thug.
Shut up and stop calling me a thug!
I could go to the cops tomorrow and bust your ass. Impersonating an officer? Attempted blackmail?
It won't happen.
I can make it happen.
Wright slowly stood, and for one horrible second made a motion as if he were about to throw a nasty punch. Then he casually pointed a finger at Kyle, and in a firm and steady voice said, You're a kid with a snoot full of law. You want to run to the cops? Go ahead. Work up your little textbook theories about who's right and who's wrong, and you know what will happen, Kyle?
I'll tell you what will happen.
You'll never see me again.
The boys across the hall, the FBI agents, are already gone.
No trace whatsoever.
Vanished. Forever. Before long, I'll have a visit with the attorney for Elaine Keenan, show her the video, look once again at the net worth of Baxter Tate, provide her with the current addresses and phone numbers and emails for you, Alan Strock, and Joy Bernardo, prod her to have a chat with the prosecutor in Pittsburgh, and before you know it, things are out of your control. Maybe charges will be filed? Maybe not. But trust me, I will destroy you. Where's Elaine? You got her in a bunker somewhere?
It doesn't matter. We have reason to believe she feels strongly that she was raped in your apartment.
Please.
She's a ticking bomb, Kyle, and the video would set her off. You have 7 more years to worry about it.
With that, Wright returned to his chair and made some notes. Kyle sat on the edge of the bed, facing the mirror.
It could get really ugly,
Wright continued.
Think about it, Kyle. Yale Law's brightest student arrested on rape charges. The women's group screaming for all 8 testicles. The video leaked onto the internet. A brutal trial? Chance of conviction? Prison? A career ruined.
Shut up.
No. So if you think I'm worried about your 2-bit threats, please rest assured that I am not. Let's talk business. Let's take the video and lock it away so that no one will ever see it. How does that sound, Kyle?
It sounded pretty damned good at the moment.
Kyle scratched his stubble as he said, What do you want?
I want you to take the job at Scully and Pershing.
Why? Now we're getting somewhere, Kyle. Now we can talk business. I thought you'd never ask why.
Why?
Because I need information.
Great. That really explains things. Thank you so much.
Bear with me for a few minutes, Kyle. You need a little background here. There are two gigantic corporations who compete with each other. Both are ruthless competitors, both are worth billions, and they really despise each other. There have been lawsuits, nasty ones, big public spectacles with no clear winner or loser. So, over the years, they have tried to avoid the courtroom. Until now. Now they're about to square off in the mother of all lawsuits. It will be filed in a few weeks in federal court in New York City. At stake is something in the neighborhood of $800 billion, and the loser might not survive. Nasty, vicious litigation. A bonanza for the attorneys. Each uses a huge Wall Street law firm. And guess what? The two law firms hate each other.
I can't wait to get in the middle of that.
That's where you're headed. One firm is Scully and Pershing. The other is A.G. Poe and Epps,
otherwise known as APE.
Yes.
I interviewed there.
Did they offer a job?
I thought you knew everything.
Only what I need to know.
I didn't like the firm.
Attaboy. Now you can really dislike them.
Kyle walked into the bathroom, ran cold water in the sink, splashed it on his face and down his neck, and for a long time stared at himself in the mirror.
Don't get tired, he told himself. Ignore the fatigue and the fear. Try to anticipate what's coming. Try to throw him a curve, mess with his timing, knock him off course.
He sat down across the table from Wright.
Where'd you find the video? Kyle asked. Kyle, such a waste of time.
If the video is used in court, then the owner of the cell phone camera will have to testify. You can't protect his identity at that point. Does he know this? Did you explain it to him? He's one of my fraternity brothers, and I'll bet he'll refuse to testify at trial.
A trial? You're willing to go to trial?
A trial holds the possibility of a conviction, which means prison. And prison, for cute little white boys convicted of rape, is not pretty. I'll bet she won't press charges.
You have nothing to bet with.
She needs money. If she can squeeze it out of Mr. Tate and a few bucks from you and the other two, she'll do it. Trust me. I wouldn't trust you with my dirty laundry.
Enough of the insults.
We'll go to her lawyer and show her exactly how to do it. Or maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just release an edited version of the video on the internet tonight. Cut out the rape and let everyone see the party scene. We'll email it to all your friends, family, prospective employers, the whole world, Kyle. See how it plays. Then maybe we'll edit it some more. Maybe include some of the rape. Post it again. When Elaine sees it, your face is in the newspaper.
Kyle's mouth actually dropped open, and his shoulders slumped. He could think of no quick response, but the one thought that hit him hard was that of being shot. Mr. Wright here was a ruthless little cutthroat who worked for some group with unlimited resources and great determination. They would ruin him. They might even kill him.
As if reading his mind, Wright leaned in a little closer and said,
Kyle, we're not Boy Scouts.
And I'm tired of this bantering back and forth. I'm not here to negotiate. I'm here to give orders. Either you follow my orders or I call the office and tell my pals to destroy you.
I despise you.
So be it. I'm just doing my job.
What a miserable job. Can we talk about your new one?
I didn't go to law school to become a spy.
Let's not call it spying, Kyle. Then give it a name, Benny. Transferring information.
Oh, bullshit. It's nothing but spying.
I really don't care what you call it.
What kind of information?
Once the lawsuit gets cranked up, there will be 1 million documents. Maybe 10 million. Who knows?
Lots of documents and lots of secrets.
We expect each of the two law firms to commit 50 lawyers to the case. Maybe as many as 10 partners, the rest associates. You'll be in the litigation section of Scully and Pershing, so you'll have access to a lot of material.
Security at these firms is extremely tight.
We know that. Our security experts are better than theirs. We wrote the book, Kyle.
I'm sure you did. May I ask what these two big companies are fighting over?
Secrets. Technology.
Great. Thanks. Do these companies have names?
Fortune 500. I'll give you more information as we progress.
So you're going to be part of my life for a while?
I'm your official handler. You and I will spend a lot of time together.
Then I quit. Go ahead and shoot me. I'm not spying and I'm not stealing. The moment I walk out of Scully and Pershing with a document or a disc I'm not supposed to have and give it to you or anybody else, I've broken the law and violated half the canons of ethics. I will be disbarred and convicted of something.
Only if you get caught.
I'll get caught.
No. We're much too smart, Kyle. We've done this before. It's our business.
Your firm specializes in stealing documents?
Let's call it corporate espionage. We do it all the time, and we're very good at it.
Then go blackmail someone else.
No, it's all you, Kyle.
Think about it.
You take the job you've always wanted, at an obscene salary, living the fast life in the big city. They try to work you to death for a few years, but they reward you. By the time you're 30, you're a senior associate making 400 grand a year. Nice apartment in Soho, a share of a weekend house in the Hamptons, a Porsche, a circle of friends who are all smart and rich and moving up as fast as you are. Then one day, the lawsuit is settled. We disappear. The statute runs out in Pittsburgh, the video is finally forgotten, and at the age of 32 or 33, you're asked to join Scully and Pershing as a full equity partner. $1 million or $2 million per year. The pinnacle of success, a great career ahead of you. Life is great. And no one there will ever know about the transferring of information.
A headache that had been smoldering for the past hour finally matured and hit hard in the middle of his forehead. Kyle stretched out on the bed and massaged his temples. He closed his eyes, but in the blackness managed to keep talking. Look, Benny, I know you don't care about morals or ethics and such things, but I do.
How exactly am I supposed to live with myself if I betray the confidences of my firm and its clients? Trust is the most important thing a lawyer has. I learned that from my father when I was a teenager. All we care about is getting the information. We don't spend too much time pondering morality.
That's about what I figured.
I need a commitment, Kyle. I need your word.
Do you have any Tylenol?
No. Do we have an agreement, Kyle?
Do you have anything for a headache?
No.
Do you have a gun?
In my jacket.
Let me have it. A minute passed without a sound. Wright's eyes never left Kyle, who was motionless except for his fingers pressing gently on his forehead.
Then Kyle slowly sat up and asked in a whisper, "How much longer are you planning to stay here?"
Oh, I have lots of questions. I was afraid of that. I can't keep going. My head is splitting.
Whatever, Kyle. It's up to you. But I need an answer. Do we have an agreement? A deal? An understanding?
Do I really have a choice?
I don't see one.
Neither do I.
So?
If I have no choice, then I have no choice.
Excellent. A wise decision, Kyle.
Oh, thank you so much.
Wright stood and stretched as if a long day at the office were finally over. He reshuffled some papers, fiddled with the video camera, closed the laptop.
Would you like to rest, Kyle?
Yes. We have several rooms. You're welcome to take a nap if you'd like, or we can continue tomorrow.
It's already tomorrow.
Wright was at the door. He opened it and Kyle followed him out of the room, across the hall, and into room 222. What had once been an FBI command center had now been converted back to a regular $89 a night motel room. Ginyard and Plant and the other fake agents were long gone, and they had taken everything. Files, computers, enlarged photos, tripods, briefcases, boxes, folding tables. The bed was back in the center of the room, perfectly made up.
"Shall I wake you in a few hours?"
Wright asked pleasantly.
No, just leave me alone.
I'll be across the hall.
When Kyle was alone,
He pulled back the bedspread, turned off the lights, and soon fell asleep. Chapter 6. Contrary to his best intentions, Kyle awoke several hours later. He desperately wanted to sleep forever, to simply drift away and be forgotten. He awoke in a warm, dark room on a hard bed, and for a second wasn't sure where he was or how he had managed to get there. His head was still hurting and his mouth was dry. Soon, though, the nightmare returned, and he had the urgent desire to get away, to get outside, where he could look back at the motel and convince himself that the meeting with Detective Wright had not really happened. He needed fresh air, and maybe someone to talk to. He eased from the room and tiptoed down the hall, down the stairs. In the lobby, some salesmen were gulping coffee and talking rapidly, anxious for the day to start. The sun was up, the snow had stopped. Outside, the air was cold and sharp, and he inhaled as if he'd been suffocating. He made it to his Jeep, started the engine, turned on the heater, and waited for the defrost to melt the snow on the windshield. The shock was wearing off, but the reality was even worse. He checked his cell phone messages. His girlfriend had called 6 times, his roommate 3. They were worried. He had class at 9 a.m. and a pile of work at the law journal. And nothing, girlfriend, roommate, law school, or work, held the slightest interest at the moment. He left the Holiday Inn and drove east on Highway 1 for a few miles until New Haven was behind him. He ran up behind a snowplow and was content to putter along at 30 miles an hour. Other cars lined up behind him, and for the first time he wondered if someone might be following. He began glancing at the rearview mirror. At the small town of Guilford, he stopped at a convenience store and finally found some Tylenol. He washed it down with a soft drink and was about to drive back to New Haven when he noticed a diner across the street. He had not eaten since lunch the day before and was suddenly famished. He could almost smell the bacon grease. The diner was packed with the local breakfast crowd. Kyle found a seat at the counter and ordered scrambled eggs, bacon, hash browns, toast, coffee, and orange juice. He ate in silence as the laughter and town gossip roared around him. The headache was fading fast, and he began plotting the rest of his day. His girlfriend might be a problem. No contact in 12 hours, a night spent away from his apartment. Highly unusual behavior for someone as disciplined as Kyle. He certainly couldn't tell her the truth, could he? No, the truth was a thing of the past. The present and the future would be a life of lies, cover-ups, thievery, espionage, and more lies. Olivia was a first-year law student at Yale, a Californian, UCLA graduate, extremely bright and ambitious, and not looking for a serious commitment. They had been dating for 4 months, and the relationship was far more casual than romantic. Still, he did not look forward to some stuttering tale of a night that simply vanished. A body closed in from behind. A hand appeared with a white business card. Kyle glanced to his right and came face to face with the man he had once known as Special Agent Ginyard, now wearing a camel hair sport coat and jeans.
"Mr. Wright would like to see you at 3 p.m., after class, same room," he said, then disappeared before Kyle could speak.
He picked up the card. It was blank except for the handwritten message, "3 p.m. today, room 225, Holiday Inn." He stared at it for a few minutes as he quickly lost interest in the remaining food in front of him.
"Is this my future?" he asked himself. "Someone always watching, following, waiting in the shadows, stalking, listening?"
A crowd was waiting by the door for seating. The waitress slipped his bill under his coffee cup and gave him a quick smile that said, "Time's up." He paid at the cash register, and outside refused to scan the other vehicles for signs of stalkers. He called Olivia, who was sleeping.
"Are you all right?" she asked.
"Yes, I'm fine. I don't want to know anything else. Just tell me you're not hurt."
"I'm not hurt. I'm fine, and I'm sorry."
"Don't apologize."
"I'm apologizing, okay? I should have called."
"I don't want to know."
"Yes, you do.
Do you accept my apology?"
"I don't know."
"That's better. I expect some anger here."
"Don't get me started."
"How about lunch?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I'm busy."
"You can't skip lunch."
"Where are you?"
"Guilford."
And where might that be?
Just down the road from New Haven. There's a great little place for breakfast. I'll bring you here sometime.
Can't wait. Meet me at the grill at noon. Please. I'll think about it.
He drove back to New Haven, refusing every half mile to glance at his mirror. He slipped quietly into his apartment and took a shower. Mitch, his roommate, could sleep through an earthquake, and when he finally staggered out of his bedroom, Kyle was sipping coffee at the kitchen counter and reading a newspaper online. Mitch asked a few vague questions about last night, but Kyle deflected them nicely and gave the impression that he had bumped into a different girl and things went extremely well. Mitch went back to bed. Complete fidelity had been agreed to months earlier, and once Olivia was convinced Kyle had not cheated, her attitude thawed a little. The story he'd been working on for several hours went like this. He'd been struggling with his decision to pursue public interest law instead of taking a big job with a big firm. He had no plans to make public interest law a career, so why go there to begin with? He would eventually work in New York, so why delay the inevitable? And so on. And last night, after his basketball game, he decided he had to make a final decision. He turned off his phone and took a long drive, east for some unknown reason, on Highway 1, past New London and into Rhode Island. He lost track of time. After midnight, the snow picked up and he found a cheap motel where he slept for a few hours. He had changed his mind. He was going to New York, to Scully and Pershing. He spilled this over lunch, over a sandwich at the grill. Olivia listened with skepticism but did not interrupt. She seemed to believe the story about last night, but she was not buying the sudden change in career plans.
You must be kidding,
she blurted when he hit the punchline. It's not easy, he said, already on the defensive. He knew this would not be pleasant.
You? Mr. Pro Bono? Mr. Public Interest Law? I know, I feel like a turncoat. You are a turncoat. You're selling out, just like every other third-year law student.
Lower your voice, please, Kyle said as he glanced around. Let's not have a scene. She lowered her voice, but not her eyebrows.
You said it yourself 100 times, Kyle. We all get to law school with big ideas of doing good, helping others, fighting injustice, but along the way we sell out, seduced by big money. We turn into corporate whores. Those are your words, Kyle.
They do sound familiar.
I can't believe this.
It took a couple of bites, but the food was not important.
We have 30 years to make money, she said. Why can't we spend a few years helping others?
Kyle was on the ropes and bleeding.
I know, he mumbled lamely.
But timing is important. I'm not sure Scully and Pershing will defer. Another lie, but what the hell? Once you start, why quit? They were multiplying.
Oh, please. You can get a job with any firm in the country, now or 5 years from now.
I'm not so sure about that. The job market is tightening up. Some of the big firms are threatening layoffs. She shoved her food away, crossed her arms, and slowly shook her head.
I don't believe this, she said.
And at that moment, Kyle couldn't believe it either. But it was important, now and forevermore, to give the impression that he'd carefully weighed the issues and had arrived at this decision. In other words, Kyle had to sell it. Olivia was the first test. His friends would be next, then his favorite professors. After he'd practiced the routine a few times and the lying was finally tuned, he would somehow muster the courage to visit his father and deliver the news that would lead to an ugly fight. John McAvoy detested the idea of his son working for a corporate firm on Wall Street. Kyle's selling job, though, did little to convince Olivia. They traded barbs for a few minutes, then forgot about lunch and went their separate ways. There was no goodbye peck on the cheek, no hug, no promise to call each other later. He spent an hour in his office at the Law Journal, then reluctantly left and drove back to the motel. The room had changed little. The video camera and laptop were gone, no sign of electronics anywhere, though Kyle was certain every word would be recorded in some fashion. The folding table was still ground zero, but it had been moved closer to the windows. Same 2 folding chairs. The setting was as stark as a police interrogation room somewhere deep in the basement. The headache was back. Kyle flipped the card Ginyard left behind onto the table and began with a pleasant,
Please tell this son of a bitch to stop following me.
We're just a little curious, that's all, Kyle.
I'm not going to be followed, Benny. Do you understand? Benny gave a smart-ass smile. The deal's off, Benny. I'm not going to live my life with a bunch of goons watching everything I do. Forget the surveillance, forget the wiretaps and hidden mics and email snooping, Benny. Are you listening? I'm not walking down the streets of New York wondering who's behind me. I'm not chatting on the phone while thinking some bozo might be listening. You've just wrecked my life, Benny. The least you can do is allow me some degree of privacy.
We have no plans.
That's a lie, and you know it. Here's the new deal, Benny. We agree right now that you and your goons stay out of my life. You don't eavesdrop, you don't follow, you don't hide in the shadows or stalk or play your little cat and mouse games. I'll do what you want me to do, whatever the hell that is, but you have got to leave me alone.
Otherwise?
Oh, otherwise. Otherwise, I'll take my chances with Elaine and her bogus rape charge. Look, Benny, if my life is going to be ruined, then what the hell? I get to pick my poison. I have Elaine on the one hand, and I have your goons on the other.
Benny exhaled slowly, cleared his throat, and said, Yes, Kyle, but it is important for us to keep up with you. That is the nature of our work. That is what we do.
It's blackmail, pure and simple.
Kyle, Kyle, none of that now. That doesn't move the ball.
Please, can we forget about the ball? That's so tiring now.
We can't just turn you loose in New York.
Here's my bottom line. I will not be stalked or watched or followed. Do you understand this, Benny?
This could pose a problem.
It's already a problem. What do you want? You'll know where I live and where I work. They're basically the same place for the next 5 years anyway. I'll be at the office 18 hours a day, if not more. Why exactly will it be necessary to keep me under surveillance?
There are procedures we follow.
Then change them. It's not negotiable.
Kyle jumped to his feet and headed for the door. When do we meet again?
Where are you going?
Benny asked as he stood. None of your business, and don't follow me. Do not follow me.
Kyle had his hand on the doorknob.
Okay, okay. Look, Kyle, we can be flexible here. I see your point.
When and where?
Now.
No, I have things to do without being watched.
But we have so much to talk about, Kyle.
When?
How about 6 tonight?
I'll be here at 8, and for only 1 hour. And I'm not coming back tomorrow.
Chapter 7. At the New Haven train station, Kyle boarded the 722 for Grand Central. He wore the better of his two suits, a plain white shirt with an utterly boring tie and black wingtips, and he carried a handsome leather attaché case his father had given him last Christmas. He also carried the morning's editions of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and he was indistinguishable from the other sleepy-eyed executives hustling off to the office. As the frozen countryside blurred by, he ignored the papers and let his mind wander. He asked himself if he would one day live in the suburbs and be forced to ride a train 3 hours a day so his children could attend fine schools and ride their bikes down leafy streets. At the age of 25, that was not very appealing. But now most of his thoughts about the future were complicated and dreary. He'd be lucky if he didn't get himself indicted and/or disbarred. Life in the big firms was brutal enough, and now he would have the impossible chore of grinding through the first years while stealing confidential information and praying daily that he didn't get caught. Maybe commuting wasn't such a bad deal after all. After 3 days and many hours of talking, haggling, bitching, and threatening, Benny Wright had finally left town. He had receded into the shadows, but, of course, would soon materialize again. Kyle hated his voice, his face, his mannerisms, his calm, hairy hands, his slick head, his confident, pressing manner. He hated everything about Benny Wright and his company or firm or whatever it was, and many times during the past week he had changed his mind in the middle of the night and told them all to go to hell. Then, in the darkness, as always, he could feel the handcuffs, see his mugshot in the newspapers, see the looks on the faces of his parents,
and worst of all, he could see himself afraid to glance at the jurors when the video was played to a hushed courtroom.
"Is she awake?"
Joey Bernardo asks while Baxter Tate has Elaine down on the sofa.
"Is she awake?"
The words echo around the courtroom. The countryside vanished as the train sped through suburbs and towns, then it went underground, at some point dipped under the East River and entered Manhattan. Kyle strolled through Grand Central and hailed a cab at the corner of Lex and 44th. Not once had he looked over his shoulder. Scully and Pershing leased the top half of a building named 110 Broad, a sleek glass edifice with 44 floors in the heart of the financial district. Kyle had spent 10 weeks there the previous summer as an intern, the typical big firm seduction routine of socializing, lunching, bar hopping, watching the Yankees, and putting in a few light hours of work. It was a joke of a job, and everybody involved knew it. If the wining and dining worked, and it almost always did, the interns became associates upon graduation, and their lives were basically over. It was almost 10 a.m., and the elevator was empty. The lawyers had been at their desks for hours. He stopped at the 30th floor, the firm's main lobby, and paused for a second to admire the massive bronze lettering that informed all visitors that they were now on the hallowed turf of Scully and Pershing. Attorneys at law, all 2,100 of them, the largest law firm the world had ever known. The first and still the only firm to boast of more than 2,000 lawyers. Counsel to more Fortune 500 companies than any other firm in the history of American law. Offices in 10 U.S. cities and 20 foreign ones. 130 years of hidebound tradition. Magnet to the best legal talent money can buy. Power, money, prestige. He already felt like a trespasser. The walls were covered with abstract art. The furniture was rich and contemporary. Some Asian whiz had done the decorating, magazine quality, and there was a brochure on a table that went into details, as if anyone who worked there had the time to stop and ponder the interior design schemes. A gorgeous little receptionist in stiletto heels took his name and asked him to please wait. Kyle turned his back on everything and became entranced in a work of art so bizarre he had no idea what he was looking at. After a few minutes of mindless gazing, he heard the receptionist call, "Mr. Peckham is waiting, two floors up." Kyle took the stairs. Like many Manhattan law firms, Scully and Pershing spent money on the elevators, reception areas, and conference rooms, the places clients and other visitors might actually see. But back in the bowels of the firm, where the grunts worked, efficiency ruled. The halls were lined with file cabinets. The secretaries and typists, all women, worked in tight cubicles within reach of each other. The copy boys and other gophers worked on their feet. New York real estate was simply too expensive to provide them a spot or a nook of any significance. The senior associates and junior partners were awarded small offices on the outer walls, with a view of similar buildings. The rookie associates were stuffed in tight, windowless spaces, three or four of them wedged together in cramped cubicles, nicknamed cubes. These offices were tucked away and kept out of sight. Lousy accommodations, brutal hours, sadistic bosses, unbearable pressure. It was all part of the blue-chip law firm experience, and Kyle had heard the horror tales before he finished his first year at Yale. Scully and Pershing was no better and certainly no worse than the other mega firms that threw money at the brightest students, then burned them up. At the corners of each floor, in the largest offices, the real partners anchored things and had some say in the decor. One was Doug Peckham, a 41-year-old litigation partner, a Yale man who had supervised Kyle during his internship. They had become somewhat friendly. Kyle was shown into Peckham's office a few minutes after 10 a.m., just as a pair of associates were leaving. Whatever the meeting was, it had not gone well. The associates looked rattled, and Peckham was trying to calm down. They exchanged greetings and pleasantries, the usual banter about good old Yale. Kyle knew that Peckham billed $800 an hour, at least 10 hours a day, and therefore the time that Kyle was now wasting was quite valuable. "I'm not sure I want to spend a couple of years doing legal aid," Kyle said, not too deep into the meeting. "Don't really blame you there, Kyle," Peckham said in a quick, clipped voice. "You have too much potential in the real world. This is your future." He spread his arms to take in his vast empire. It was a nice office, large by comparison, but not a kingdom.
I really would like to work in litigation.
I see no problem there. You had a great summer here. We were all impressed. I'll make the request myself. You know, though, that litigation is not for everyone.
That's what they all said. The average career of a litigator is 25 years. The work is high pressure, high stress. Peckham may have been 41, but he could easily pass for 50. Completely gray, dark circles, too much bulk in the jowls and around the waist. Probably hadn't exercised in years.
My deadline has passed, Kyle said.
When? A week ago?
No problem. Come on, Kyle, editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. We'll be happy to cut you some slack. I'll talk to Woody and personnel and clear it. Our recruiting has gone very well. You're joining the best freshman class in years.
The same was said about every freshman class at every major firm.
Thanks. And I'd love to work in the litigation practice group.
Got it, Kyle. Consider it done.
And with that, Peckham glanced at his watch. Meeting over. His phone was ringing. There were hushed voices just outside his door. As Kyle shook his hand and said goodbye, he decided he did not want to become another Doug Peckham. He had no idea what he wanted to become, or if he would in fact become anything other than a disbarred lawyer, but selling his soul to become a partner was not in the plans. Associates were waiting at the door, sharply dressed young men not much older than Kyle. Smug, harried, nervous, they stepped into the lion's den, and as the door closed, Doug was raising his voice. What a life. And this was an easy day in litigation. The real pressure was in the courtroom. On the elevator down, Kyle was struck by the absurdity of what he was expected to do. Upon leaving the offices of Scully and Pershing and riding the elevator like hundreds of others, he was expected to have hidden somewhere upon his person or within his effects top-secret information that belonged not to him but to the firm, and especially to its client. And he would give this valuable data to Benny with the hairy hands, or whatever his real name was, who would then use it against the firm and its client. Who am I kidding? He said to himself. There were four others on the elevator. Sweat popped out above his eyebrows. So this is what my life boils down to. A chance of prison for rape in Pennsylvania, or a chance of prison in New York for stealing secrets. Why not a third option? 4 years of college, 3 years of law school, 7 rather successful years, all the potential in the world, and I'll become a highly paid thief. And there was no one to talk to. He wanted out. Out of the elevator, the building, the city, out of this predicament. He closed his eyes and talked to himself. But there was evidence in Pennsylvania, and none in New York. Yet. He was certain he would get caught, though. Months before any crime was committed, he knew he would get caught. 2 blocks away, he found a coffee shop. He sat on a bar stool in the window, and for a long time looked rather forlornly at 110 Broad, at the tower that would soon become his home, or his prison. He knew the numbers, the statistics. Scully and Pershing would hire 150 new associates worldwide, 100 in the New York office alone. They would pay them a nice salary that would amount to about $100 an hour, and the firm would in turn bill their well-heeled clients several times that rate for the associates' work. Kyle, like all rookie grunts on Wall Street, would be expected to bill a minimum of 2,000 hours a year, though more would be required to make an impression. 100-hour work weeks would not be uncommon. After 2 years, the associates would begin dropping out and looking for more sensible work. Half would be gone in 4 years. 10% of his freshman class would survive, claw their way to the top, and be awarded with a partnership after 7 or 8 years. Those who didn't drop out along the way would be squeezed out by the firm if they were not deemed partnership material. The work had become so awful that the trend was for firms to market themselves as quality of life firms. The associates were expected to bill fewer hours, have more vacation, and so on. More often than not, though, it was simply a recruiting gimmick. In the workaholic culture of every big firm, the greenest associates were expected to bill almost as much as the partners, regardless of what the recruiters mentioned over lunch months earlier. Sure, the money was great. At least $200,000 to start with. Double that in 5 years as a senior associate. Double it again in 7 years as a junior partner.
well over $1 million a year at the age of 35 as a full partner with a future filled with even higher earnings.
Numbers, numbers. Kyle was sick of the numbers. He longed for the Blue Ridge Mountains and a non-profit salary of $32,000 without the stress and pressure and hassle of life in the city. He yearned for freedom. Instead, he had another meeting with Benny Wright. The cab stopped in front of the Millennium Hilton on Church Street. Kyle paid the driver, nodded at the doorman, then took the elevator 4 floors up to a room where his handler was waiting. Benny motioned to a round table with a bowl of bright green apples in the center, but Kyle refused to sit or remove his jacket. "The offer is still good," he said. "I'll start in September with the other associates."
"Good. I'm not surprised. And you'll be in litigation?"
"Peckham thinks so." Benny had a file on Doug Peckham, as well as files on all of the litigation partners and many of the firm's other lawyers.
"But there's no guarantee," Kyle added.
"You can make it happen."
"We'll see."
"Have you thought about an apartment here in Manhattan?"
"No, not yet."
"Well, we've done some homework, looked around."
"Funny, I don't recall asking for your help."
"And we found a couple of places that will be ideal."
"Ideal for who?"
"For you, of course. Both places are in Tribeca, fairly close to the office."
"What makes you think I would even remotely consider living where you want me to live?"
"And we'll cover the rent. Pretty pricey real estate."
"Oh, I see. You'll find an apartment for me and pay for it so I won't need a roommate.
Is that it, Benny? One less person for you to worry about. Helps to keep me isolated.
Plus, the rent means that we're financially joined at the hip. You pay me, I give you secrets, just a couple of shrewd businessmen, right, Benny?
Apartment hunting is a bitch in this city. I'm just trying to help."
"Thanks so much. No doubt these are places that can easily be watched, maybe even wired or bugged or compromised in ways I can't even imagine. Nice try, Benny.
The rent is $5,000 a month.
Keep it. I can't be bought. Evidently, I can be blackmailed, but not bought."
"Where are you planning to live?"
"Wherever I choose. I'll figure it out, and I'll do so without any involvement on your part."
"As you wish."
"Damned right. What else do you want to talk about?"
Benny walked to the table, picked up a legal pad, and studied it as if he didn't know what he'd already written on it.
"Have you ever seen a psychiatrist?" he asked.
"No."
"A psychologist?"
"No."
"A counselor or therapist of any type?"
"Yes."
"Details, please."
"It was nothing."
"Then let's talk about nothing. What happened?"
Kyle leaned against the wall and folded both arms across his chest. There was little doubt in his mind that Benny knew most of what he was about to explain. He knew far too much. "After the incident with Elaine, and after the police finished their investigation, I talked to a counselor in Student Health Services. She referred me to a Dr. Thorpe, a specialist in drug and alcohol addiction. He roughed me up, got under my skin, forced me to take a long, hard look in the mirror, and he convinced me the drinking would only get worse."
"Were you an alcoholic?"
"No, Dr. Thorpe didn't think so. I certainly didn't either. But there was too much drinking, especially of the binge variety. I seldom smoked pot."
"You're still sober?"
"I quit drinking. I grew up, found some different roommates, and have never been tempted. I've yet to miss the hangovers."
"Not even an occasional beer?"
"Nope. I never think about it."
Benny nodded as if he approved of this.
"What about the girl?" he asked.
"What about her?"
"How serious is the relationship?"
"Not sure where you figure into this, Benny. Can you help me here?"
"Your life will be complicated enough without a romance. A serious relationship could pose problems. It's best if you postpone it for a few years." Kyle laughed in frustration and disbelief. He shook his head and tried to think of an appropriate retort, but nothing came to mind. Sadly, he agreed with his tormentor, and the relationship with Olivia was going nowhere fast.
"What else, Benny?
Can I have some friends? Can I visit my parents occasionally?"
"You won't have the time."
Kyle suddenly headed for the door, yanked it open, then slammed it as he left. Chapter 8. There is a student lounge on the first floor of the Yale Law School.
and on the walls outside its door are posters and notices advertising internships and even careers in public interest law. The students are encouraged to consider spending a few years helping battered women, neglected children, death row inmates, immigrants, runaway teens,